actually talk about, and they're somewhat disjoint, so really this is going to be two separate talks back to back. So when I'm talking about small-scale structure, I'm talking here about things that are too small to be directly resolved in Milky Way-sized simulations and too small to host visible structure. And this is my kind of cartoon of what's going on here. So up the top, in terms of theoretical input, we've got primordial power spectrum from inflation or whatever, and then we've got the dark matter particle microphysics. Those two things combine to produce your processed power spectrum. So at this point, you can work this out. This is all fairly well established, but then you throw this into nonlinear structure formation, and this is where things get very messy and very complicated. And most of the rest of the talks this afternoon are going to cover all this here, so I'm going to leave that in the capable hands of the other speakers. And then once you've dealt with nonlinear structure formation, what you really want to get out is the dark matter distribution today on very small scales. And the reason you want to know that is if you're trying to detect dark matter either indirectly via the annihilation signals, which we've already heard a lot about, or directly in the lab. So my sort of color coding here is the boxes with solid lines around them are things that I think are reasonably well established. The things with dotted lines around them are where there's still lots of work that needs to be done. And I'm going to focus on things in bold yellow. That's why we need to know the local dark matter distribution for direct detection and the theoretical input that goes into the top of this calculation. So I'm going to start off with the motivation for why we need to know the local dark matter distribution for direct detection experiments. So everything I'm going to be talking about is specifically WIMPs. And so if you're trying to detect WIMPs in the lab, you're doing it via elastic scattering. So that's that we're sat in the Milky Way. If the Milky Way halo contains WIMPs, they'll be streaming through this, huge numbers of them streaming through this room sort of all the time. Most of them will stream straight through because they're weakly interacting, but a tiny fraction of them will elastically scatter off of the nucleus, and they'll just do it and disappear again. So what direct detection experiments do is they set up dedicated experiments trying to detect these very rare nuclear recoils. And so what you're basically trying to do is detect the energy that's input into the detector by the recoil. And you can detect that through numerous channels, ionization, scintillation, or if you've got a cryogenic detector by raising the temperature. And experiments typically will look for two or three of these channels. And the reason for doing that is it helps them distinguish nuclear recoils from recoils of electrons due to backgrounds. So why do we want to know the WIMP distribution? Well, we want to know what the energy spectrum of these recoils is. And there's two reasons for that, basically. Firstly, it's really becoming clear that if we really want to detect dark matter, we're probably going to have to do it via more than one channel. We'll probably want some sort of signal from the LHC, some sort of indirect signal maybe from glass, and then combine that with something in the lab and hope that all these things are consistent and add up to a single sort of set of properties for the WIMP. So what we'd really like to do is if we saw something, we'd like to establish the WIMP properties, and if you don't see something, you want to constrain the WIMP properties. And then more mundanely, unfortunately, neutrons can come in and cause a nuclei to recoil in exactly the same way that WIMPs can. So one of the ways you can try and distinguish WIMP recoils from neutron-induced nuclear recoils is by looking at the energy spectrum. So you want to know what the energy spectrum of your nuclear recoils looks like. And so here's the equation for the event rate. This is the number of counts per unit energy, per unit time, per unit detector mass. This is slightly simplified. It's assuming that there's been independent coupling between the WIMP and the nucleus. And I've highlighted in yellow the bits where the sort of astrophysics come in. We've got the local WIMP density here. Obviously, higher that is, the more WIMPs we've got, the more scattering events we've got. I've also highlighted it's directly proportional to the scattering cross-section. So what you can see automatically there is there's a degeneracy here. You only be able to measure or constrain the cross-section as well as you know the density. And then the additional piece of astrophysical input comes here. This is the speed distribution of your WIMPs in the rest frame of the detector, which is sat on the Earth. And then we've got some kinematics going on here. And this is simply just because there's a minimum WIMP speed that can cause a recoil of energy E. So this is what goes into giving you out what an experiment can potentially see.
Why do you have a V in the denominator? Why?
It's simply sort of consider the flux of things coming through the detector. There's a 4 pi.
Because we have a kinetic energy in the denominator.
Ah.
So you have the flux and times V divided by half mv squared.
I see. Okay, I see.
So what sort of potential signals could you actually go looking for, in particular if you want to be sure that you're seeing WIMPs and not neutrons?
Well, the first thing is, because we've got, in various places in this equation, we've got the target mass number of the target, and it also crops up here in this minimum velocity, speed, sorry. That means that your energy spectrum depends on your target. And so this is a plot of differential event rate as a function of energy for a WIMP mass of 100 GeV in red for a germanium target and blue for xenon. So this, the idea would be that if you use two different detectors and compare what your recall spectrum looked like and check that they were consistent. There's also an annual modulation, and that's because we're probing the WIMP distribution in the rest frame of the detector. The sun's going around the center of the galaxy at about 220 kilometers a second, and we're sat on the Earth, which is orbiting the sun. So what that means is that our velocity with respect to the galactic rest frame varies over the course of the year. And what that means is that the flux of WIMPs hitting your detector also varies over the course of the year. And so that's a smallish effect. It's of order a few percent. So what you need is a very big detector, and you need to run it stably for a large period of time to see that. Another consequence of the fact that we're moving with respect to the galactic rest frame is that most of the WIMPs are going to be coming from the forward direction. So if you could build a detector that can measure not just the energy of the nuclear recoils, but also the direction, you'd be able to look for this. So this is a plot of the WIMP flux projected, and this is the direction of solar motion, so most of the WIMPs are coming from the forward direction. So the advantage of this is a much bigger signal than the annual modulation, but unfortunately it's a lot harder to build a directional sensitive detector. And then finally, something which doesn't get mentioned that often, but you also get diurnal modulations, in particular in this peak recoil direction, due to the fact that the Earth's rotating. And so one thing I should emphasize here is that all of these plots of recoil differential event rate, annual modulation, and the direction dependence assume that the WIMP velocity distribution is an isotropic Gaussian. So that's the simplest thing you can assume, but it might not be right. So here's just very quickly a selection of current experiments. So I've listed them there with some details about what targets they use, what exposures they've got, and which channels they're looking for. And traditionally, the results from these experiments are plotted like this. We've got the WIMP mass here from 10 GeV up to 1,000 GeV, and here's the cross-section. And so as Gianfranco has already told us, we've got typically these exclusion limits where everything above the solid line is excluded. And at the moment, the best exclusion limits are coming from CDMS and xenon 10. Also, I've plotted on here these dotted lines of the sort of improvements in the exclusion limits that are expected over the sort of near future. The messy blobs here are the theoretical expectations, and the problem here is that supersymmetry has lots and lots of free parameters, so exactly where you expect to be in this parameter space depends on exactly how you deal with those parameters. And then finally, this blue region here is the DAMA experiment. They've been running for a long time with a big detector, and they see an annual modulation in their event rate. So this is the region of parameter space which corresponds to their annual modulation with some simplifying assumptions.
The regions which are excluded at 2 sigma?
Typically, yeah, 95% confidence, okay. Yeah.
So if I wanted to show on the same plot the region, the line below which you can discover a particle at 5 sigma, for instance, like to claim discovery, how?
Not much is the answer. I guess you'd want 5 events, whereas this is probably coming from having not more than 2.7 or something.
Okay.
So it'd be a factor of something like 2.
So it would be more or less the same, you think?
Then it wouldn't change hugely, but it depends how many events you think you need to be convinced. You know, would 5 be enough? I don't know.
All right.
But that they wouldn't change hugely.
How far down below the bottom of the plot do the models go?
You can sort of tune the couplings in the model to basically get your cross-section to essentially zero. So, yeah, I mean, it's convenient that you can sort of cut this off here at the point that you can go sometime soon, but yeah.
So around the 10 to the minus 8, roughly how many events do we expect in one of these experiments, like
So, I mean, the limits at the moment are 10 to the minus 7.
I just mean, you know, like, roughly how many units?
Yes, I'm thinking aloud to skip. So, I mean, you're talking an order of magnitude, sort of. So, at the moment, they'd be seeing nothing. You've got to scale the size of your detector up by an order of magnitude to get your limits down. So, I mean, the final thing I was just sort of pointing out, you've got some angular modulation there. So, these plots are always calculated assuming the standard halo model that you've got smooth distribution of WIMPs on the insular neighbourhood, the distribution is Gaussian, and the dispersion is given by the local circular velocity, 220 kilometres a second, and also that the local dark matter density is 0.3 GeV per cubic centimetre. So, the exclusion limits, if you change the local density, you just shift all of these up and down. If you change the shape of the speed distribution, you change the shape of these exclusion limits a bit. But however, if you start changing the wind speed distribution, you change the shape of this allowed region by a huge amount. I'd like to be able to tell you exactly how much, but given the information that's publicly available about the dam results, I can't do that. But this region, so you should bear in mind that this has some simplified assumptions, so just because these exclusion limits come down below this allowed region doesn't naively mean that they're ruling out. There are assumptions about not just the astrophysics that I've emphasised here, but also about the particle physics when you're doing this comparison.
Actually, I have a quick question. Maybe you or Paolo can answer this. What's the status of the DAMA anode modulation below 10 GeV? Is that still...
That's a Paolo question. So,
is that still allowed by CDMS? CDMS?
So I think your question is there because I published a paper with your meeting some time ago showing that the DAMA region actually extends to all masses, and then they stopped it there. You see the vertical line on the left?
Yeah.
The blue region? Just because some theories told them that the dark matter cannot be lighter than 40 GeV, and they leaked. So extending the region to all masses, and it was below the limits, around 4 or 5 GeV. The big new data at the end of last year, Texono, that practically excluded that region for the standard halo model. However, if you allow modifications, then there's still the room. Okay. But the standard of all is tracked by the fluid by the new taxonomy data.
Okay.
So, one of the caveats to all of this, though, is the relevant scales involved are absolutely tiny. So, to give you an estimate, the Earth's moving with respect to the galactic restroom about 200 kilometres a second, and say an experiment lasts for about a year. During that time, we'll move less than a milliparsec. So what we're probing is the dark matter distribution averaged over milliparsec scales. So this is many orders of magnitude smaller than most astronomical problems. You know, astronomers think things on kiloparsec and bigger scales. So this is just a completely different scale to need to know what the dark matter distribution is doing. And it's also many, many orders of magnitude smaller than what you can directly probe using a numerical simulation of a Milky Way-sized halo. So the big question for direct detection experiments is actually, well, we know that structure forms hierarchically, we have these small things, they lose mass. The question for direct detection isn't whether these things survive, because even if most of them do survive, the probability of us being inside one of these small halos is absolutely tiny. So the pertinent question for direct detection is what happens to the material that's torn off of the smallest halos. So if, and I'm not saying this is definitely the case, but at the moment I don't know of any argument that this isn't possible, is that we don't really know how many streams compose the local dark matter distribution on these milliparsec scales. It could be large numbers, we've got a nice smooth dark matter distribution, or it could be a small number. I'm not aware of a convincing calculation of that yet. So what if the local dark matter distribution just consists of a small number of streams? So I've just got a completely random example, picked from thin air of three streams. We've got some peaks of different amplitudes at sort of three positions. So remembering that the differential event rate is an integral over the speed distribution, what this then maps into is our differential event rate, instead of being something nice and smooth, consists of steps. And the heights are related to the heights and velocity peaks, and their positions are related to the speed. And this would then make analysing data from an experiment difficult. One new signal wouldn't look quite like what you're expecting, and also it'd be difficult to disentangle any information about the WIMP properties from a single experiment. You've got a degeneracy between the density of the streams and the cross-section,
And also you've got a dependency between the position. The position of these steps depends on the position of the streams, which you wouldn't know sort of off the top of your head. So the thing to emphasize though is if we do have a large number of streams making up the local dark matter distribution, then we're going to be back to a nice sort of smooth exponential thing here. So I think at least that at the moment this is an unanswered question as to whether the dark matter distribution really is smooth or not on these sub-milliparsec scales.
Springle, they had a paper saying that there's 10 to the 5 of them.
They're saying 10 to the 5. So that paper, and I guess Mark's going to talk about this tomorrow, it has an extreme sophisticated calculation allowing you to track the formation of causticks and the density decreasing the stream. But as far as I'm aware, and Mark, please contradict me if I'm wrong here, is that the 10 to the 5 is a back-of-the-envelope calculation. And so it's not really too clear to me exactly where it comes from. I think at some level it's coming from the fact that you think you know what the local dark matter distribution is, you know how the density in a single stream scales, you sort of divide them. Mm-hmm. But we know what the local dark matter density is over kiloparsec scales. So I think the 10 to the 5 might end up applying to a much bigger box than we're interested in. Do you want to add anything?
Well, yeah, that's right. We take it as the mean density over the number of the We take the number of streams as the mean density we calculate in the simulation over the stream density we calculate with this approach, and then we end up with this number. From my point of view, this is correct, and this should give you, I mean, even in the local neighborhood of the sun, should give you the number of streams correctly. And also, if you do simulations, what Amina did, I think five years ago, where they actually followed the satellites falling in and then extrapolated this, they also got these number of 10 to the 5, so I think this number should be more or less correct.
Well, how can you trust the resolution of your simulation, especially 5-year-old simulations?
Well, we've done it now with this new method where we have, so to speak, more resolution, and then we get more the same.
More resolution, okay. I mean, you need to have a high enough resolution to trust to have at least convergence in the simulation. So maybe we should ask the Alaska to simulate.
But they have a comparable simulation now, even better. But as, so you still get 10 to the 5, or you get...
All we can say is on tens of parsec scales, so it's hard to say what that really means for the sub-milli parsec scales. So I would agree that this is somewhat an application.
It's also, it's a very different potential in the real world, right? Because it's completely baryon dominated. And the baryons are not distributed like particles in simulations, nor like dark matter. So it's not necessarily going to be scale free at all, for instance, on those scales.
If you look at the galactic potential, I mean, what we did, for example, we assumed this triaxial potential of the halo. And if you look at these potentials, then you have a lot of chaotic orbits. And these chaotic orbits will dramatically decrease the stream densities. And this is why you end up with this high number. So we did the calculation, and we find a quite high percentage of chaotic orbits near the solar neighborhood, and they have very low stream density because the stream density for these chaotic things just decreases exponentially, and not like a power law for regular motion in a non-chaotic potential. So this is why I think that the number of streams should be quite high, and you can assume more.
Number 10 to the 5 comes from regular orbits, and if they are chaotic.
Yeah, this was a low estimate. I mean, if you take into account also chaotic orbits, then this number goes even up. So this was only based on regular orbits.
So are you going to talk about this tomorrow? Or?
Well, tomorrow the focus is on the caustics.
So okay. So
I guess that more or less wraps up why you need to worry about small-scale dark matter distribution for direct detection. It might be sensible if anyone's got any questions up to this point to ask them now rather than at the end. No, nothing. Okay. So then shifting backwards to the other end of the problem, I'm now going to sort of try and give you a brief overview of the theoretical input which goes into this. And by contrast, I think this is all reasonably well established now. There are two things, the particle microphysics and the primordial power spectrum. And I'm going to split the particle microphysics down into sort of three sections, a basic calculation for generic WIMPs, then the refinements of the damping calculation that have been made recently, and then finally to give you some numbers for concrete WIMP candidates. So there's been a large stream of papers working on the particle microphysics going back to more than a decade ago when people started realizing this was important. like to emphasize the paper in bold by Stefan Hoffman, who's at the, there at the back, and Dominic Swatch, which was really the first paper to sort of tackle this problem head on and get to grips with most of the nasty details. Then I'm going to talk about some work which I did with Stefan and Dominic, mainly, well, partly because I was involved with it, and partly because I think it just encapsulates all the basic ingredients that are needed. And then other things sort of to highlight is then there's been some refinements by Lopez Aldariaga and Birchinger, which I'll mention briefly later on. So our basic calculation of generic WIMPs, we make a number of assumptions. Firstly, that the WIMPs are in thermal and chemical equilibrium in the early universe. So that's not the case for WIMPzillas, and it's also not the case for axions. So nothing I'm going to say applies to axions. I think there's probably some very interesting sort of axion microphysics that still needs to be worked out, but everything I'm going to say today applies just to WIMPs. I'm going to assume standard cosmology, that's a period of radiation domination up to the relatively recent past, and then matter domination. I'm going to assume that WIMPs are the only CDM component, although you can sort of probably drop that assumption without causing yourself too many problems. And that there's no WIMP anti-WIMP asymmetry. And then for this generic calculation, I'm going to assume that the thermal average of the elastic scattering cross-section is given by the weak cross-section scale, and then this temperature divided by mass scaling. And we look at two possibilities. One, L equals zero, which is sort of what you'd expect for a standard model light particle. And then also L equals one, which is more like what you'd expect for supersymmetric particles. So chemical decoupling, this is kind of the standard law of WIMPs. And so here's a very standard plot of co-moving number density is essentially a function of time. And so in the very early universe at high temperatures, this reaction goes in both directions and co-moving number density remains roughly constant. As the temperature drops, though, it stops happening in this direction, so you've just got the WIMPs annihilating and the co-moving number density falls off rapidly. If that was the end of the story, the WIMPs would all annihilate and there'd be none left to be the dark matter. But fortunately, it isn't the end of the story because the WIMPs are weakly interacting. That means that eventually the reaction stops going in this direction too, and we end up with a constant number density of WIMPs. And what number density we get left with depends on exactly how weakly interacting they are. But you can do some very rough calculation that says that anything that has interaction cross-section order the weak scale ends up with roughly the right density today to be the dark matter. And so we did the calculations, our generic WIMPs obey Boltzmann statistics, and there for the records of the equation for the WIMP density. And you can solve this to work out the temperature at which they chemically decouple, parameterized in terms of this X parameter here, which is the mass divided by the temperature. And that's something in the ballpark between 20 and 25. So that's saying that WIMPs chemically decouple at a temperature of order tens, hundreds of GeV. Now, obviously, when people actually really do calculations for specific WIMP candidates, you numerically solve the Boltzmann equation and you factor in all the relevant annihilation channels. So it was always sort of thought that that was the standard law. The WIMPs froze out and then that was that. But Stefan and Dominic realised that this, actually there's more important microphysics still to come. And that's after the chemical decoupling, the WIMPs can carry on interacting kinetically with the other particles, and in particular leptons. So that's just that they elastically scatter off them. So the number density of WIMPs is remaining constant, but you'd be able to affect their kinematics. Eventually, though, the WIMP density decreases even more, and you stop these interactions. Although the crucial point here is, though, that it's not the relevant timescale isn't the timescale at which these interactions stop. It's actually a different timescale, and that's because it's the relaxation time that matters. It takes many of these interactions to cause deviations from thermal equilibrium, and that's because the momentum transfer in each one is of order of temperature, and that's small compared with the momentum. So you need a large number of interactions to keep or to make deviations from thermal equilibrium. So the point being that the relaxation timescale is much smaller than the timescale, sorry, much larger than the timescale on which individual collisions occur. So you can estimate the collision timescale simply from the thermal average of the elastic scattering cross-section, and from this estimate the relaxation timescale and hence the kinetic decoupling temperature. And so for our two cases of generic WIMPs, the standard model-like particles, and more supersymmetric ones, you're getting these temperatures of order, in this case, a few MeV, and here a few tens of MeV. So these are much smaller than the chemical decoupling temperatures. And so here's a plot. On this axis, we've got the chemical decoupling temperature in GeV, because it's for L equals zero, this is the L equals one case.
and this is the kinetic decoupling temperature in MeV. The colour code here is the Wimp mass in GeV going from 0 through to 1000 GeV, and these models have been selected to produce the correct WMAP density. So the main point to take home here is that the kinetic decoupling happens at temperature of order 10 MeV, whereas the chemical decoupling is of order 10 GeV, but there's a significant range in both cases, and that will be important in a moment. So an important sort of side effect of the kinetic decoupling is that actually during this period in between the chemical decoupling and the kinetic decoupling, these interactions also transfer energy between the radiation and Wimp fluids. And this is Stefan and Dominic showed in their earlier paper. This is due to bulk and shear viscosity. And so what you can do is you can write down these coefficients for these two things and then solve for the evolution of the density perturbations in terms of a linearized Navier-Stokes equation. You've got to make some assumptions to do that, and I'll come back to the effects of those assumptions in a moment. What you end up with is this equation for how the density perturbations evolve with time. And you can solve this quite simply, and you get exponential damping with this characteristic wave number given by this equation here. And putting some numbers in, you get something of order 40 inverse parsecs, with a dependence on the Wimp mass and also the kinetic decoupling temperature. That still isn't quite the end of the story. So after the kinetic decoupling, the Wimps are free to free stream. This is the same sort of thing as neutrinos do, and so neutrinos free stream over big scales because they're moving very fast and raise density perturbations over very big scales. The Wimps are doing the same thing, but they're moving far slower, so they're raising density perturbations over far smaller scales. But you can do a calculation that's, you know, effectively the same, and you can work out what the characteristic free streaming scale is, and it's something of order an inverse parsec, with again a mass and dependence on the mass and the kinetic decoupling temperature. And this is essentially set by the velocity at kinetic decoupling, which is then sort of related to the temperature at kinetic decoupling. So again, here's a plot of these two quantities for the sort of simple generic Wimps we looked at. And so the thing to take home is that the free stream incoming wave number is the smaller number, so it's the bigger physical scale, and so that's the dominant effect. It's the free streaming that ends up causing a cutoff in your power spectrum. But it's worth noting here that even for our generic Wimps, there's roughly an order of magnitude variation in the free streaming cutoff wave number, and obviously mass goes as scale, length scale to the 3, so that's giving us about 3 orders of magnitude variation in the cutoff mass scale. So those diagrams are actually K. So this is K times parsecs to give you something done. The way we wrote that is possibly unnecessarily confusing. So putting all of this together, the other thing we did was calculate the transfer function. That's just how the fluctuations grow due to gravity. I'll spare you the details of that because they're not particularly interesting. But what we ended up calculating is the process power spectrum had a redshift of 500. So this is sufficiently early that everything's still linear. You can do it analytically. And the calculation I'm showing you here is for 100 GeV Beano-like Wimp, and we're assuming a scale invariant WMAP normalized primordial power spectrum. And I'll come back to that assumption in a moment. So here we have our power spectrum. It's a function of co-moving wave number. Without the microphysics, you'd end up with this increasing to ever smaller scales. We've got our microphysics, though, is producing a cutoff here. The other thing you can calculate analytically is you can estimate the sort of redshift at which things go nonlinear. That's when fluctuations become of order 1. And the standard way of doing that is you take your power spectrum and you integrate it over a window function. That's essentially going from Fourier space to real space. And you say that the scales go nonlinear roughly when this sigma, which is basically the RMS size of fluctuations, is of order 1. And so this plot here shows the redshift at which things go nonlinear as a function of co-moving sort of real space. And as you go to smaller and smaller physical scales, things will form earlier and earlier. But with the cutoff in the power spectrum, that turns into this plateau here, which means that the smallest things form from fluctuations on co-moving scales of about a parsec, and typically do so with the order of 10, redshift of tens. The one further thing you can do analytically is estimate the mass and radius of these things by just assuming simple spherical top hat claps. And so you get this relationship between the mass of the object you form and the size of the fluctuations before collapse. We're talking about, for typically, things 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 7 solar masses. But remember, we've got a sort of order of magnitude variation in this K, which maps into three orders of magnitude variation in the mass. And then finally, obviously, your fluctuation is much smaller once it's collapsed. And you can estimate that, and you're coming up with things of orders from 0.01 parsecs. So, mentioned quickly, refinements of the damping calculation. So, we've sort of tried to capture all the essential physics in an intuitive way. And so afterwards, people came along and looked in more detail at some of the aspects of the calculation and found that you get these, as well as this sharp cutoff, underneath the sharp cutoff, you get these, basically these oscillations in the density perturbations. That's basically because of some coupling between the CDM fluid and the baryons, which are oscillating. So, the CDM picks up the oscillations of the baryons. And if you want to have really sort of accurate calculation, then I recommend this paper by Birchinger. He does the whole thing, basically. This is a plot from his paper, though. So you can see he's picking up these oscillations, but the envelope is very well matched by an exponential cutoff. So I think, as we'll see from the next few talks, there are so many uncertainties in what happens to these small structures once they form, that these oscillations probably aren't going to make a calculable difference to anything we can actually calculate or see. And then finally, to highlight another paper by Stefan, where he sort of tidied up some of the details and did a calculation of kinetic cut-to-coupling from first principles. So what I've told you today is mainly a slightly simplified story, but when you do this whole calculation a bit more carefully, you really, things don't change a huge amount. So the other thing you might be interested in is concrete WIMP candidates. And so, as Gianfranco already mentioned, there are basically two, well, there are more than two, but there's two main well-motivated WIMP candidates. There's the lightest neutralino and supersymmetric models, and then also recently there's been interest in the lightest Kaluza-Klein particle in universal extra-dimension models. So these guys came along and they did a calculation of the kinetic coupling temperature in these models, and they used this relation from the Loeb and Zaldarriaga paper to estimate the resulting cutoff scale. So these are plots. This is WIMP mass, kinetic decoupling temperature, and here we end up with that being translated into the cutoff wave number, or equivalently the mass scale in units of the Earth mass. So that's the Earth mass up there. And you're getting a variation from 10 to the minus 6 to 10 to the 2 times the mass of the Earth. So try and say something sensible but short about the models. So what they're highlighting is MSUGRA is looking at a restricted model, because as has been mentioned, supersymmetry has a large number of free parameters. So if you want to do calculations, you have to make assumptions to deal with these things. So basically MSUGRA, you only have 5 free parameters, so you're ending up with the smallest variation in these things. What they're calling MSSM is they tried to do a scan over sort of one way of doing it, of sort of trying to see what happens once you drop those assumptions. And so what they're seeing is you're getting a wider range of WIMP masses. These are some really big WIMP masses here. You're also getting a wider spread in the kinetic decoupling temperatures and hence the mass scales. And then they looked at sort of a handful of benchmark models. And I think the ones to highlight here are ones where they're tuning things so that you're getting neutrinos with masses close to the WIMP mass. What that is doing is these residences are enhancing the cross section, which is reducing the kinetic decoupling temperature and therefore enhancing the cutoff scale. So I think it's just emphasizing the point that the exact position of the cutoff scale depends very much on actually the microphysics of exactly how the particles interact. The Earth mass, which people quote all the time, is reasonably generic, but you should bear in mind that there's going to be potentially a variation of several orders of magnitude around that. So finally, coming on to the final ingredient, the primordial power spectrum, which is far more simple, but in some ways at least is uncertain. So obviously, what your process power spectrum is depends on what the input primordial power spectrum was. And so the simplest thing you can do is assume that it's featureless and scale invariant. That's the same amount of power on all scales at horizon crossing. However, if inflation is generating those primordial perturbations, then fairly generically you expect small deviations from scale invariance. And for instance, the latest WMAP analysis, if they don't have running, they're finding values of n, which are, they're not yet ruling out n equals 1, but they're finding values which are beginning to become significantly smaller than n equals 1. Alternatively, if they allow running, then there's no evidence for non-zero running, but it's not ruled out. And so the point here is that the scales produced by the CMB are much, much, much bigger than the relevant scales for small-scale structures. So even a small amount of tilt or running on cosmological scales can run down to potentially significant changes on the small scales we're interested in. So we looked at some simple models. So these were range of inflation models. And we chose these to be consistent with the WMAP first year results. Obviously, the exact numbers have changed since then, but the point more or less remains the same. So we looked at a false vacuum dominated hybrid inflation model with n bigger than 1 and no running. The benchmark scale invariant model, a power law inflation model with n less than 1 and no running, and then an m squared phi squared chaotic inflation model with the same value as n as our power law model, but with some running. And so this then is what you end up with as your process power spectrum and the redshift at which things go nonlinear. So just with these small deviations from scale invariance, you're getting about an order of magnitude variation in the amplitude of the power spectrum on these small scales. Or equivalently, this maps into a variation of order to 10 in the terms of the redshift at which things go nonlinear. Another upshot will be that as well that the density of things is determined by the density at the time they form. And so the earlier things form, the higher the density, so it will have effects on the survival probabilities for these things too. So, I mean, as I said, things have changed a bit with more recent WMAP data, but I think the variation isn't going to change too much. And even then, should emphasize that just assuming a simple scale-free power spectrum is, again, a big assumption. You can create inflation models quite easily, which have features in the potential. So at some level, we're always going to be limited by the fact we have to make assumptions about what the power spectrum's doing on scales that we can't otherwise probe. So finally, to wrap up, summary of the first bit was, bottom line is that WIMP direct detection experiments need to know the WIMP velocity and density distribution on submillion parsec scales. And for me, that was the motivation that then got me into this small-scale structure formation. The theoretical input to that you can be divided into two things, the particle microphysics and the primordial power spectrum. But the bottom line with the microphysics is that free streaming erases density perturbations on scales smaller than about a parsec. And so consequently, the first smallest WIMP halos to form have mass of order the Earth, but there is some variation of orders of magnitude in that number. And whilst I showed you sort of a basic calculation of this, if you wanted a really detailed calculation of the exact shape of the process power spectrum, then you have to do that numerically. And then finally, the other input is the primordial power spectrum, and the cutoff scale is many orders of magnitude smaller than the scales that are constrained by cosmological observations, so we've got to extrapolate. And so even small deviations from scale invariance can have a significant effect once you extrapolate down to these very small scales.
Other questions?